Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, hello there and welcome along to this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Looking forward to bringing you a special edition of the show today, broadcasting a session that took place at Spring Harvest at Home when I was invited to lead an after-hours panel on the subject of Do We Need to Rethink Worship in the Age of COVID-19. I'll be introducing my guests and you'll be hearing the broadcast we made on that night. Thanks very much to Spring Harvest for letting us re-air it for Unbelievable. Of course, the situation on COVID and churches meeting and so on has moved on a bit in the UK in the last month or two, but many of the same challenges still exist that we talk about on the show today. Later on in the programme, I'm also chatting with an old university friend of mine, John Yates. He has a new book out called Fractured: Why Our Societies Are Coming Apart and How We Can Put Them Back Together Again. So look out for that on the end of today's show. Don't forget also, you can get hold of the digital download of Unbelievable 2021 at unbelievable.live. It's great to hear all the great feedback we've had from the conference, and of course, last week we put out a few special moments from the conference on the podcast. We're already planning our 2022 event, you'll be glad to know. But if you'd like to get hold of all the video sessions in high definition on the digital download, again, unbelievable.live. Let's get into today's show.
Well, good evening and welcome along to a special discussion event tonight here on Spring Harvest at Home. I'm Justin Brierley and it's my absolute pleasure to welcome you to this discussion on Do We Need to Rethink Worship in the Age of COVID-19? And I've got a special panel of guests that I'm joined, both in studio and remotely as well. So let me introduce them to you. Firstly, here in studio, Moiwa joins us. Moiwa has just been leading a wonderful evening of multicultural worship from all over the world. So Moiwa, you can... I was just loving what happened tonight at Spring Harvest. It was just wonderful to see all the different worship expressions. And I don't get to see enough of you singing at work, because we work together.
Yes, we do.
You're the station director of Premier Gospel.
Yes.
But I don't hear your lovely voice enough, you know.
Well, it's been a year apart, hasn't it?
It has.
Today is the first day that I'm seeing you in over a year, even though I see you on Teams every day.
Exactly.
But it's such a joy to be here, be a part of Spring Harvest, even though it's online.
Well, I'm just glad we were able to be together at last, even though we're joined by guests who are remote, and I'll introduce them as well. Tim Hughes, well known as a worship leader as well and vicar of Gas Street Church in Birmingham. Tim, you've got a new book that's just come out as well, and we've been hearing about that already at Spring Harvest. Do you want to just tell us the title of the book that you've released recently?
Yeah, funny enough, I've got it here. Worship. There you go. Never miss a moment. It's actually, I can't claim that I've written it. I've written a couple of chapters and edited it with a great friend and colleague, Dr. Nick Drake. And it's lots of different contributors speaking into this huge topic of worship, why we worship, what happens in worship, how we can grow in worship. So, it's just come out and excited to partner with Spring Harvest on it.
Fantastic. Great to have you with us tonight as well, Tim.
Thank you.
And Graham Nichols joins us as well, also coming in via Zoom. Graham is director of Affinity. It's a network of churches in the UK. And Graham, actually, you recently wrote an article for us, which we'll come to, for Premier Christianity magazine, arguing for why churches should actually get back to in-person worship. But before we get to all that, tell us a little bit about Affinity and your work with them.
Yeah, it's a network, so it's only as good as the last thing it did in a way. It's not a denomination, it's just a grouping of churches. And we try and meet with each other, talk about best practice, encourage one another, pray for one another, host events. And as director, I try and sort of pull it together, do some work on the media, Christian media, secular media, trying to sort of speak up for that network of churches. And then we're trying to engage with what's happening in our culture and what's kind of happening theologically. But in the rest of my time, I'm also a pastor of a local church in Haworth, in West Sussex, called Christ Church Haworth.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining us tonight, Graham. And last but by no means least is Lucy Briley, who is the minister of Woking United Reformed Church and happens to be my wife. So, Lucy, welcome along as well. And we're going to be sharing, I suppose, both of us a little bit of our experience during the past year and how COVID has shaped and changed the way that we deliver worship, as it has for so many church leaders around the country. But do you want to just give a little bit of an intro to you?
Yeah, see, I'm the minister of a local church. I'm a local church leader. It's been a year like no other, and yet we have seen so many blessings, both in the church community, but also in our family, as we've learnt to worship and to lead worship together as a little team thrown together in our house, in those four walls together for all that time. And it's just been amazing to see what God's done in the life of the church. And in the life of our kids as well.
Yeah. So that's our panel. And my name's Justin. I host a regular sit-down show called Unbelievable, where I bring different people, often non-Christians, together for dialogue and discussion. It's called Unbelievable. And you can listen every week on Premier Christian Radio on Saturday evenings, but also via its podcast and video channel as well. So we're actually going to be re-airing this conversation, actually, on our Unbelievable show in a few weeks' time. But I'm really glad that we can do this live tonight here at Spring Harvest at Home. Let's just hear a little bit from all of you, first of all, what this period has looked like. What's changed? What the experience has been like. Maybe start with you, Moiwa. I mean, you lead worship in all kinds of different places all over the world. Mm-hmm. What has the last year looked like for you, though, when it comes to leading worship in church settings?
Like Mrs. Briley says, it's been a year like no other. So typically by now, and Tim Hughes will be familiar with this, typically by mid-year, your air miles have gone through the roof. I mean, BA would have seen me too many times. But we went through a year where, I mean, the only traveling I was doing, Justin, of course, you know, with Premier, we were all working from home, but I was in the office.
Yeah.
So the only traveling I was doing was driving from home to the office and requests to lead worship from different parts of the world was me going into a studio and recording or me recording it in the TV studios at Premier. For me, it was a little foreign, but it wasn't so foreign because of the work I do in TV. So I was already quite adjusted to it. But in terms of the experience of community, even the, because when the worship experience for us, it's not just when we stand in front of people singing, it's the relationship I have with the singers, with the musicians, with the time we get to spend together, where we find out, okay, someone's having a bad time at home and things like that. And all that just ground to a halt. It became just phone calls, you know, except when you came together. So it's been a strange one. And actually, I consciously refused a lot of engagements because I felt, you know, it's all right singing to camera, but actually I want to be in a space with other people. So there were events in Nigeria that requested that I lead worship, and I looked and I thought, I mean, maybe what I should have done was pray about it and see what, what God was saying. But I thought, nah. And so there was several from different parts of the world, from the States. But there were one or two that I said yes to, but it was strange. But it wasn't that strange. Yeah. If you ask me, what would I rather? Honestly, I'd rather be back at the Apollo, Hammersmith Apollo in person, or back at the local church in person, you know.
Yeah, of course. And I think it's been a huge learning curve for so many church leaders, worship leaders, and everyone, you know. Tim, again, you're not someone who's unfamiliar with doing things in a kind of media setting, but what's been the experience like for you, especially, you know, I guess you're a few years in now to your ministry at Gas Street Church, and then suddenly this hits. What did you do? How has that happened? What's been the reaction in terms of people watching and the kind of community, obviously, that were meeting but now haven't been able to meet for quite a while?
Yeah, so we planted Gas Street 5 years ago. We've actually just celebrated our fifth birthday. And I think, you know, just looking back and remembering, you know, those moments where suddenly the realization begins to dawn on us that we're going to be in lockdown, we're not going to be able to gather together to meet, and suddenly you've got to pivot a whole team, a whole way of working towards, I mean, two things really, particularly. One was online church, streaming stuff, pre-recording stuff, you know, quickly getting cameras into our house so we could, you know, I now know how to film myself and set up lights, you know, new skills I've had to learn, and I'm sure every pastor has at times gone absolutely crazy trying to figure out how to record something properly. And the worship, how we had, you know, changed the way we record our worship. And then of late, we've been back in the buildings, live streaming from church. So it's a whole bunch of new skills, you know, I guess pivoting a whole team towards that. Been exciting but incredibly draining. And then the second thing is, obviously, as a church in a community, we're based right in the city centre of Birmingham, the incredible need all around us and the opportunity and the idea that the church just kind of disappears into their homes and we can all watch worship and talks just seems the complete opposite of everything that the church is meant to be. And so that involved one of our church campuses turning it into a food delivery service. Suddenly we're providing, you know, hundreds of meals, actually thousands of meals a week. We're suddenly trying to connect with those who are alone, battling with their mental health. We're setting up befriending services, sort of debt counselling. And actually, we've been partnering with a whole bunch of churches around the UK in a thing called Love Your Neighbour. And our missional expression of the church has just exploded. So I would say the last year has been one of the toughest year of my life as a leader in terms of leadership, but also one of the most exciting. And I think we've seen lots of battles, but the church really stepping out and rising up to be much more dynamic, much more engaged. And we've had to really encourage people to take ownership and responsibility for their faith and to make it work. And we've seen lots of great things amidst all the difficulties and setbacks and challenges.
Graham, I mean, from your perspective and the network that you're part of, what have been the overall messages you've been receiving from church leaders, but also what's been your experience in your own local church?
Starting with the easier first, our own local. I think we had the same issue of the kind of shock and the speed. I remember well that first week of getting together a service. We actually went live from the very first Sunday we were locked down. But it was crazy. We didn't really know what we were doing at all, so I don't know why we did it, but we did, and we've been live ever since. And so all similar experiences to what you've been talking about, you know, in terms of getting used to doing lots of things we hadn't done. I think for the network of churches, you get a variety of settings. You've got some churches where there's a big staff team, they've already got lots of technology going on, and in a way that they were able to fairly smoothly, you know, a few wrinkles, but basically segue into doing it. And then you've got smaller churches that kind of just didn't know what to do, that they haven't got the technology, haven't got the resources. A lot of their congregation were not online and sort of you know, highly sort of skilled up. So those were kind of different challenges. I think for the network, my job, apart from sort of preaching and local church ministry, is kind of bringing people together in meetings. And you can sort of do that, and they've been pretty successful for the last year, but they're much more limited and functional, and they're less relational. You know, so a typical meeting is shorter, so it's more efficient, but you get very little intro and very little outro. you don't have the cup of tea, you don't have the kind of, you know, standing by the water cooler, the waiting for the toilet or whatever, you know. You don't get all those chats around a meeting, mm-hmm. even quite a formal meeting. There's always bits at the beginning and bits at the end, and people who say, oh, can I just have a chat with you for 5 minutes, you know, when the meeting's over. You don't get any of that really on Zoom. So I think that's been sort of challenging. Relationships have tended to plateau or to flatline. That yes. makes it sound like they're dead, but you know what I mean? They just stay at the same level.
Yeah.
But that's been a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for sharing it. Luce, do you want to share a little bit of our experience?
Yeah, I was thinking back to the last Sunday before lockdown when we were worshipping in the church, and actually the church was half full, if you remember, because people were already getting nervous about this virus. But we had a young man in our church who was being baptised that day, and we were so determined, and he was so determined to press on, so we had this service. And I remember saying in that service, you know what, I don't know if we're going to be here next week, but even if we have to live stream something from our front room, we'll be back. We will be worshipping somehow together. And I don't know if I really meant it at the time. I really didn't know what I was saying. One of our elderly members came to me and said, you don't mean that we won't be able to come to church. I mean, it's just unthinkable.
It was unthinkable
absolutely
at the time.
Absolutely unthinkable.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet there we were next Sunday. Our daughter had a cough by this stage. We couldn't leave our home. So we did. We set up your phone on the tripod in our front room. We shut the curtains, Facebook Live, and that was the beginning of our journey.
Yeah, yeah. And we were in that, you know, sitting room scenario for probably 4 or 5 months at the beginning. Then we latterly started to live stream from the church and so on. Yeah. Every church, in a sense, has had a different experience at some level, but they've all had very similar experiences as well about having to adapt to new technology. And with it have come, I think, good things and, of course, challenges and hard things as well. So I wonder, maybe could you speak to this first of all, Tim? What for you have been the major blessings of all of this? But what, specifically, I suppose, the live streaming of the worship service? I mean, I know worship is much bigger than just what happens on a Sunday morning. But nonetheless, that's where a lot of people are still connecting with church. That's their primary point at which they're going to be, you know, seeing their church leader and worship being led. But what are some of the big benefits of suddenly it all being online? What are some of the big drawbacks, in your view?
Yeah, well, a big benefit, I think, has been we've been able to reach far more people, and particularly people who would never usually come to church. I think for our congregation to invite their friends has never, ever been easier. And every week we're getting emails, stories of people who maybe haven't been to church for years, maybe never been to church before, becoming Christians, engaging. I think it's something like 75% of our congregation have invited a friend who's come to view something online. So we're really mindful now in our worship, in our teaching, that there are people watching who've never been to church, who don't necessarily believe. And so I think it's provided an amazing evangelistic opportunity. So that's been a huge, huge benefit and blessing and opportunity. I think the other thing that's been really good is, and we've had to work at this to build the culture of this in terms of, now we've done Zoom for like small groups and a whole bunch of different things, but for our services, we've streamed them on YouTube. But with all the chat, what we've loved, and we've seen this in our prayer meetings, which have been on Instagram, actually people can be commenting throughout a talk, throughout the worship, thanking God for something in their lives. So actually it's felt like you've engaged and you're hearing more from all the church rather than just the person preaching or the person singing the songs. And that's been beautiful. And I love seeing, you know, someone will post, you know, oh, please pray during the worship. Please pray. I've got a job interview, you know, on Monday. And then suddenly, you know, Barbara from Dudley's praying. Yeah, and all of this stuff has been amazing to see people will hear what's going on in people's heads during gathering. So I think we've actually seen it's engaged people. You're hearing from people, and people have adapted well. So I think the other thing that's been brilliant is it's just created a pioneering, experimental kind of posture in the church where sometimes we can get so fixed on a way of doing things. And I think the disruption provides and brings fresh energy, opportunity to try new things, and everyone's a bit more open. So I think we've really, really appreciated that. I mean, the downsides, I'm sure we're going to come on to a lot of this, we're created for that personal connection, you know, being in someone's presence and seeing one another, you know, that actually is such a significant part of our worship. Our gathered worship is looking around and seeing that there are others who love Jesus, who are trying to put him first in their everyday living, and that actually are gathered, kind of we encourage one another in our worship, and that's much harder when you can't see one another. Yeah, so I think we've really missed what happens, what God by his Spirit does when people actually physically meet in a room together. And I'm excited to see more of that as we re-emerge out of lockdown and begin meeting in person again.
I mean, that's obviously the light at the end of the tunnel. We all can't wait to be back, you know, gathered and be able to do stuff. Obviously, it's going to be kind of a slow road to that. And even at this point, when as much as churches can gather, it's behind masks, socially distanced, no singing at the moment. I mean, Moira, how are the church communities that you're part of and that you speak to, how have they reacted to that? How have they felt about not being able to gather for a good portion of time? And when they can gather under very different conditions, you know, the exuberant worship that you might expect, you know, just it can't happen in the same way, can it? Because people can't be, you know, praising in the same way that they normally are. So what's been the effect of that in terms of the way people have received the worship?
It's been a wide variety of emotions and reactions that, I mean, just for me, on a personal level, one of the big pluses is this was a period where I've got two sons. Oluwaloni Chibweze is 13, and Oluwabimeleke is Chinomo, so he's 10. And in this period, my sons, whilst engaging with worship online, decided, they came to me and my wife and said, Dad, can we, and I think I've shared this in our exec meeting, Justin, a premier, and they said, Dad, would like to speak in that heavenly language you and mummy speak. And what are you talking about? And my 10-year-old goes, you know. And so we do a journey of who is the Holy Spirit, and we do all, and that all happened because we were at home. Now, speaking to church leaders, I mean, the church that I go to, the local assembly, I belong to, Liberty Church, the numbers, like Tim said, the numbers rocketed. So there's one service that the church would usually do. It's a church that's now maybe 5 years old. The leader had been in the Redeemed Christian Church of God, but came out. But the church meetings on Sunday mornings, probably 800, 1,000 people. Now it has services. We have services where, I mean, you go on YouTube, over a million views.
My goodness.
Services. Yeah. The church built an app where thousands of people are engaging with the church. So those are some positives. But then on the other, that's just one side of it. On the other side, there are people who I know whose church is just shut down for them because. Now, some people would argue that, okay, God did a clean up and cleaned out his house, etc. You know, that's not really my street. I leave that to you theologians. But all I know is that there are people who were church leaders, and all of a sudden it's evaporated, and all the negative emotions that go with that. And I know, you know, it's nothing new, because when you look at history, whether you go to the Justinian plague, which it shows that when that happened, it really decimated the West, as it were. And then Islam was able to make massive inroads in Syria, in Turkey, and places like that. And I think you've seen some of that with some of these churches that have gone under, because you've seen some people who have just had massive questions that haven't been answered, and they've fallen. I mean, there was one, forgive me for being so long-winded, there's one gentleman who I spoke to on Saturday in my sister's house. This chap was a church leader, and having been through all that, what's happened, and other things as well, he sat down there and he said to me, how can this God be the real God when he's allowed, now he was a church leader, when he's allowed all these, and he narrates all these things that's happening. So on the one hand, there's great victories, great strides made forward. On the other hand, there's some casualties left behind.
Absolutely. And I think that's been our experience, Luce, with
we've also had that story of, wow, we're seeing all these new people coming online and engaging, and suddenly the net is thrown wide. But it's also, it's how do you minister to and pastor people that you've never met, that you know, and that kind of thing.
It's really hard because, you know, we are reaching more people. There's absolutely no doubt that it's so much easier for people to dip their toe in the water on Facebook or YouTube than it is to walk in a building. Of course it is. And we have, as church leaders now, we've got to ask ourselves the question, well, how do we reach these people? How do we stop church being a spectator sport? I've had people say to me, you know, church is great now. I can be there in the kitchen making my porridge with church, you're on in the background. And I'm like, what? What's happening? And so, and I'm thinking, we don't know until times change. We don't know how many people are going to come back together. We don't know how many people are going to carry on making their porridge whilst they're watching church. But we don't know also how can we, what is the Holy Spirit doing in the lives of these people who are dipping their toes in the water and wondering, what is this church? Yeah. Who is this God that I'm seeing these people sing and talk about on the screen? How do we as church leaders reach them and move this from a spectator sport into a living relationship? Yeah. You know, there's our challenge for the next years.
And in a way, I suppose my fear has always been, as much as there were, especially at the beginning of lockdown, lots of great stories about, look at how many people are watching our YouTube.
Yeah.
You always wonder, well, how many, you know, of those were like people who dipped in for 3 seconds and when, or how many of these are kind of genuinely kind of connecting with? Because it's much harder, as we know, to connect through a screen than it is to connect in person.
I've got to say, though, there's a gentleman who used to be a pastor here in the UK, young guy. He was, when he left here, he was 29, 30. And he's gone to Africa, he's been pastoring out in Africa. And second year of his pastoring, pandemic hits. And I was speaking to him again just recently, and I was asking, so how do you, with all these young people, and his church is very young because the country is in 70% of the population are under 30, right? And we're talking almost 200 million people. So he's really having a great time vibing with these young people on digital platforms. So I said to him, but how do you disciple them?
Yeah.
How it's just not a nice party that everyone has. And he says that they have this program where they do on WhatsApp. And he talks me through this journey that they take people through on WhatsApp, which honestly, when I heard him describe it, I thought, my goodness, a bit intense, you know, because they'll have up to 150 young people an hour each day.
Wow.
On WhatsApp, talking about Bible, and then the young people asking questions, and they get real personal about what is it that you're grappling with and struggling with, and they do that for 6 weeks. Full on, and then I just thought, my goodness, my first question was, would I allow my son to be a part of that?
Yeah.
But that's what they're doing,
that's
to keep the connection.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You're listening to a special edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This was recorded for Spring Harvest at Home just after Easter, where we were asking the question, do we need to rethink worship in the age of COVID-19? In the company of some great worship and church leaders, Tim Hughes, Moira, Graham Nichols, and my own wife, Reverend Lucy Brierley. We'll be continuing in just a moment.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the second part of today's edition of the show, asking, do we need to rethink worship in the age of COVID-19? This was recorded for Spring Harvest at Home just after Easter and includes questions from the watching audience as well. Good news is that Spring Harvest will be happening in 2022 in person, back in person for 2022. You can find out more at their website, springharvest.org. And I think the booking opens very soon in June. So go to them to find out more about next year's event. But for now, let's get back into the subject as I ask Graham Nichols about why he thinks it's really important for churches to meet in person.
You've been banging the drum recently, and you wrote a couple of blogs for Premier Christianity magazine about the importance, as you see it, of churches when they can to embrace the in-person. Because obviously there's a lot has been made about the great things that can be done online, but you think actually we're missing out if we don't get back to in-person as soon as we can.
Yeah, I think both theologically and also just experientially, the in-person gathering is kind of unrivaled in terms of kind of being embodied with each other. Now, I know, you know, like we're doing now in Zoom, there's quite a rich experience. You get to see me richly, but it's not the same. And it, as I said before, it doesn't have that kind of wraparound. We've done our best in our church since the beginning to live stream because it's more of a sense for most of the meeting. We have recorded songs and stuff, but for the sort of main bulk of the leading and the preaching, for that to be live, because at least there's a sense that we're all having the same experience at the same time. I know the Holy Spirit's not limited, and you know, he can work in time shift as easily as he can in real time. But I think there's something about collectively hearing the same thing, singing the same songs at the same time, hearing each other singing, hearing people praying if it's that kind of a meeting, experiencing the Holy Spirit as the word is preached, as he is praised, all happening at the same time, kind of in our physical bodies, saying that our bodies matter. It's not just about kind of ideas that we're exchanging over the airwaves. We're actually kind of giving of ourselves. So I think churches should take every opportunity to meet live. I think there are challenges. I don't know if we're going to talk about some of the... there are challenges in doing a hybrid because of the different kind of dynamics. But I think where we can, doing as much live as possible is a good thing.
And I suppose the hard thing is, though, as you say, at this point in where we're at, even where you can meet in person, it's going to be socially distanced, behind masks, no singing at this point. Now, we hope that'll change in due course. But I can imagine a lot of people just saying, well, it's not like church. You know, at that point, is it even worth turning up? Because you can't see people, you can't really engage, you can't do all of those things that make it church. So you can kind of understand why some church leaders say, well, we're not even going to go back until we can kind of do what we normally do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do understand that. And it's a weird experience where, I'm sure Tim knows as well, particularly for sung worship, the dynamics of doing something in the room sort of live is a different experience for those who are watching online. If you have pre-recorded that you're then showing in the room, but you can't sing to it, it's in a way you have a more stilted experience in the room than you do if you're at home where you can sing as loud as you like.
Yeah.
So there are all those challenges going on, like you say. But I still think it's better to be in the room if you can be. I think the level of engagement is much higher. You know, lots of people have said to me, yeah, we can do other things, like we were saying earlier, make porridge and so forth. And they said, when you're in the room, of course you can look at your phone, particularly if you're in a larger congregation, and you know, you can drift off in your mind. But it's harder.
Yes.
You tend to be more engaged. You're more committed. People can just kind of switch off, literally switch off, halfway through the meeting, then go make a cup of tea and walk away completely, not even be listening anymore. And there's no accountability for that. Whereas if you're in the room, you know, you've got to kind of keep engaged. And I think, you know, God uses those means to keep you engaged, to listen to the kind of, you know, a sustained message. And you can't underestimate the encouragement of just seeing other people doing the same thing at the same time. Seeing people around you who are worshipping, you know, what makes me more emotional as a preacher is seeing other people singing or praising God, or even just listening to the sermon, thinking, you know, these guys actually believe this stuff, and I can see them sort of doing it right now. And you know, of course, you can see that on Zoom, but it's not the same kind of rich, whole kind of sensory experience.
I understand that. I mean, I think what many churches have said, and I think what you've said as well, Luce, is we weren't really doing the online live thing before COVID. Suddenly we got forced to do it. And then we realised we're actually reaching people that we formerly couldn't reach, the house band that maybe we just never really served in the same way until that online. So there's definitely been these yeah. benefits, but there's also that fear of, are we kind of, over the course of doing this over a year, kind of training people into, well, this is a perfectly adequate way of experiencing church, and therefore this does become a norm for a lot of people, where we know it's not, as Graham says, there's something different about in person. I mean, is that a worry you have going forward?
It's an extraordinary worry I have. I have going forward, but I say worry. It's just something I'm aware of. Actually, I'm not worried. I think we are entering a whole new world, and I am excited actually about what God will do and can do through it. If we just surrender ourselves and say, okay, this is how it is. We don't know who's going to come back, but we will have these in-person services and we will worship, but we'll also be live streaming, and we don't know who the Holy Spirit is going to touch through that means as well. And so I think we just have to give it up to God. You know, we just can't know.
Yeah. I mean, Tim,
I think if I could say something, yeah. I think our sort of vision going forward is to really think and pray about what will work using all the benefits of technology that we've gained, but not by just trying to make a kind of one size fits all service. I think we're all going to have to think creatively about the live experience in person and the streamed experience kind of at home, which I think, as you were saying, we'll probably have to deliver for some time to come. But thinking that experience is different. So now we've learned so much. If we had the option of doing some stuff live in a room, but also to minister kind of to people remotely, if we had the time and resources, we'd probably do those two services differently rather than just broadcast the service in person. And I think we've got to think, when we've got the freedom to do a bit more, let's think about those two as two complementary, not completely parallel experiences.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Tim, I was going to put one of these questions that have come in from people who are watching from home. One person asks, when singing is such a core element to corporate worship for so many churches, what should we do instead if we can't sing together, both now and possibly in the future? I mean, this person says, what about if this goes on another year and we can't be singing in person? Now, we can all hope that won't be the case, but how have you managed that in terms of when people can't sing when they're present, and what do we do to worship in other ways, I suppose? Because it's not just about the singing, is it?
No, I mean, we actually, so on Sunday, Easter Sunday, we had our first, for quite a while, in-person gathering. So, and we were interested because we weren't sure, you know, what was going to be the demand. And so we released tickets to make it all COVID secure, socially distanced, and sure too many people didn't turn up. But what was fascinating is all the tickets, we had four gatherings, they went within 2 hours. It was like unheard of, you know, for us anyway. So it was a huge demand for people to get back in the room. And actually, it wasn't just young people. Mm. See, some of the older folk are like, get us in that building. And so I think there is a real hunger to be in that room together. Now, when it comes to singing, I think we're going to have to learn different postures, you know, our bodies, our physical posturing of worship. And again, so many of the Hebrew words for worship talk about, you know, raising hands, kneeling down, dancing. I think there's some of these things we can move into, clapping, like... Well, we had actually one of our guys preaching, and he went into a little like, let's, you know, praise God, let's all get clapping. And so I think this is an opportunity to encourage our congregations to find different ways of expressing God in our worship. But I think as well, the other thing that's really important is just the fact that we're seeing one another. And that, I mean, I think in worship, reminding ourselves that we're not alone, we're part of a family. So just the physically seeing people around you, different ages, different ethnicities, different backgrounds, reminding ourselves that the church is the one place on planet Earth where it draws together such a unique, eclectic group of people with the purpose of worshiping Jesus Christ. That in itself is powerful. And so I think praying and believing that actually just quietly praying, all of these things can make a difference. I think we're going to have to learn. I think it is, it's like exercising new muscles. I think it will feel a bit awkward at times. Some Sundays will feel great, others will feel awful. But it's quite fun. I think we're trying to say to our congregation, we're on a journey together. Yeah. We don't know how we quite do this. You know, this is all new for all of us. So let's enjoy learning together.
But you know, Justin, I think we're quite spoiled. Mm-hmm. The Western Church is quite spoiled because we've grown accustomed to how things should be, and we feel we have divine rights around certain things. When there are parts of the world where, I mean, some of it I'm familiar with because my father was a Muslim who became a Christian. And then with the TV show that I do, when you get messages from people who are from Muslim countries, who they tell you how they can't express their faith. So they don't have the leisure of being able to sing Shine, Jesus, Shine. and so they observe, you know, their worship in silence or in reflection. Mm. And I think we've been spoiled. I think we've been spoiled by people like Tim Hughes, who make such great music. They'll be like, oh man, I can't get my fix. You know, so I think that's probably one of the positives of this, in that somehow we've been weaned off things that we have created for us. We've made gods of ourselves.
That's an interesting point.
You know,
yeah.
Which really, I mean, actually, let me just, before I get myself in trouble with the theologians, you know, but I think we're just quite spoilt.
Yeah.
In the West, and we've been, some of our worship suites have been taken away, and I want my sugar.
Yeah. I mean, you wanted to speak into this as well.
Please. I did. Yeah. I think, you know, what Tim was saying about finding other ways to express that worship, as you say, for those who actually physically can't, because it will be dangerous to speak out or whatever, you know, they've had to find other ways of expressing their worship. And I think we've got two little examples in our church, and they're just little stories. But one is our five-year-old son, Toby, who, when we set up worship in our front room for the first few months of lockdown, we had the kids lined up, and there was us and the son on the bongos, and I was like, kids, everyone's going to see you all the time now, okay? Behave. And our little son, Toby, you know, we set up the music, Justin was playing the guitar, we were all singing, and our little Toby, he just started to dance. And it was his first... We hadn't really seen this from him before. He's a great big extrovert. And I think he thought, right, this is how I'm going to worship. This is how I'm going to do it. And we were like, mind the wires, all the time. But that is what he did. He just danced his little heart out. And we got messages from people saying, you know, Toby's shown me how to just set myself free. It's been great, isn't it? And just one other little quick thing is signing. One of our young members, she'd been on the fringe of our church, and she came to me, she called me up during lockdown and said, Lucy, I've done this faith signing course, Makaton, it's just simple signing. And she said, I just really want to offer it to the church in this time. I want, you know, to help us to worship. So we started a sign of the week, and now she's helping us every week in our services to use our hands in our worship. And I think it's going to be a real blessing when we go to in-person services.
Yeah. I agree that signing that Alice does in the services has become like a real central feature now. And it's not just for people who might find that helpful, who may be hard of hearing or whatever, but everyone benefits from doing the signing. Because certainly anyone who's, you know, in the building with us can't sing.
Yeah.
That if you can sign the words to a chorus, it's like you're singing with your hands. And I think there is something powerful about that when you're using not just this one instrument, but your hands, the other senses, and so on. Got a question here, Moira. You were talking about, you know, some the way young people are using technology and some of the opportunities that, even though it's sometimes uncomfortable for us because we're used to doing things in person. But this person says, do you think churches should continue and use Zoom and Facebook, YouTube, and more other means of reaching a generation that have basically been brought up online? I mean, in a way, could this be kind of the bridge that we needed almost to a younger generation who we could see kind of slipping away and, you know, in Snapchat, YouTube, not Facebook, because no young people are on Facebook, I'm told, but, you know, wherever.
Don't tell Mark Zuckerberg that.
but is this the church, has it been thrown a lifeline here to kind of say, actually, yeah, this is your opportunity to engage young people again because you've been forced to go online, forced into those social media spaces?
You know, I guess yes and no. I'm not from the school of, young people are, they're walking out and they're never coming back and we must be online to reach them. You know, I think God is powerful enough to reach the people he wants, the people he gave his son for, whether you're savvy with technology or not. I mean, some of the stories that I hear with some of the ministries I work with, where in parts of the world where there's no freedom of religion and Christ is appearing to people in their sleep, and it's happening in their droves. So, and that's without them going on Zoom. So I think God will move. But I do think, though, that if the church doesn't do this digital journey, we will miss a trick. In the same way that we've seen, and you historians would know, when you look at the plagues that have happened in the past, there's just been a gap where the church was needing to make a turn, and there have been huge moments where we haven't quite done it so well, and you could see the life of the church dwindle, and we've gone to other things. So I think young people, I mean, if all you have to do is look at Spring Harvest. The chat room for the young people was popping, whereas the older folk were busy, you know, reflecting on the exegesis of the text. Yeah. So I think the church needs to. But I do think, though, there's a thought that occurred to me as Lucy was speaking, because when you'd hear preachers talk and they'll say, oh, you know, worship is not just about the music. But most generally, when we're discussing worship, we talk about the music. So for this moment we're in, it's forced us to really respond to God in when injustice happened. What's worship in that moment? I remember for me, when the George Floyd thing happened, a brother of mine, still a brother of mine, who he felt actually quite strongly that the policeman did nothing wrong, right? And that might be a surprise to people, but some people felt the policeman didn't do anything wrong. So, and this is a brother of mine. We work together. We see each other. So we started a dialogue around this. So I'm telling him some of my stories of my experiences of having called the police to a problem. And then I became the problem without the policeman stopping to ask what happens. And he totally refused to see how this could be a problem. And then at that point, for me, it was a question of how do I respond to this? And I realized at that point that actually he's where he is. And I can't belittle his faith. I can't put judgment on him. Christ died for him like he did for me. So what's my response would be to love him and to pray for him. And for me, that was a real moment of revelation in worship, because it was like, what's my, beyond my singing? Okay, I could sing and get people to lift up their hands, but in this moment, what's the God response that you have, which shows that God is unrivaled, you know? And for me, I think one of the things that this moment in the pandemic has thrown up is that where there's no, like Matt says, Matt Redman says, when the music fades and all is stripped away, what's left? And for me, just when you were talking, Lucy, that I was reminded of that you know what, you know, it's not just the singing, it's how do I react to my next door neighbor. If I'm an American, I've seen the Confederate flag come out by my next door neighbor, but actually I believe Black Lives Matter. Yeah. Yeah. You know, how do I react? Where is Jesus in that? Where is worship in that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I just
go ahead.
Mention? Firstly, Moira, you're amazingly gracious. And thank you for sharing that story. And yeah, I mean, all of that's been deeply, deeply painful. But I think this thing around technology is so important. I mean, every church is going to have a different journey. I think every church has to be comfortable in understanding who it is they're trying to reach and what is it that they bring, I guess, to a community and area. For us, we've got a vision to really reach young people. And so technology is key because these devices, iPhones or smartphones, whatever you have, they're not kind of separate from people. They're an expression of who they are, you know, that social media, whatever, TikTok, Instagram, whatever it is. They don't sort of see these technologies as a sort of separate thing from outside. It's such an important part of who they are, how they do life, how they communicate, how they express everything. And so I think there's a really exciting opportunity for the church to engage in a whole bunch of that stuff. So for us, thinking about, you know, actually when people are in church, that at the 10 a.m. on Sunday, you know, I'm there in the talk, enjoying the worship, but I'm also following on YouTube. You know, it's the two worlds are colliding. I think sometimes people can think, oh, people are on phones in church, it's a terrible thing. But actually, for a young person, they might be taking notes, or they might be, I mean, they also quite possibly will be on Facebook or something else, but they might be, you know, streaming a little clip, which then 300 of their friends see, or, you know, so I think we've got to train and educate and disciple young people, not just young people, but particularly young people around boundaries and disciplines and how these things don't completely consume us, which is a massive topic. And as a parent, it freaks me out. But at the same time, if we can't use this stuff to help and disciple and allow people just find different ways of getting gospel truth, healthy input into their lives, we're going to miss out. And so I think actually all of this is providing the church huge, huge opportunities. Again, I mean, Justin, you see this, podcasts are going crazy. Mm-hmm. And I was just reading, we've historically been in a zone where the talk has to be 20 minutes, has to be really fun, engaging, and people's short attention spans. We're now loads of these people and high proportion of young men listening to podcasts that are 1 hour, 2 hours long.
Yeah.
So maybe we need to have a little rethink. Maybe actually, and with technology, you know, it could be you do your talk on a Sunday that is 25 minutes, and then you release a few days later like an hour long discussion around that topic where it's a bit.
I thought you were going to say an hour long sermon. You know, the uncut edition of your sermon.
Exactly.
But yeah,
editor's version. Director's cut.
I think that's all amazing, and there are so many opportunities that technology affords us, and for me it's about harnessing the technology rather than letting the technology dominate us and the way we engage it, isn't it? And that's always going to be the challenge in the church, outside the church. Graham, do you want to talk to this as well?
Yeah, just I thought Tim had a really good point that we've got to think about who we're trying to reach, because obviously we want to reach everyone with the gospel and we want to preach God's word to everyone, but it is worth us thinking, okay, at the moment in this particular piece of content, who do we want to reach? And then when we've kind of decided that, thinking what's the best way to reach them. And I think it sounds very kind of media-ish, but you know, we are curators of content once we start putting it out on the web or on the little packages, and we need to think creatively and more carefully about packaging up. Sounds so sort of cynical, but I don't mean it in that way. I mean using the best of all that we've got, and sometimes it will be clips that engage people. Sometimes it will be longer discussions. Sometimes we need to think. Just to go back slightly, I think lockdown has made me a slightly better preacher. Slightly better preacher. In that when you're looking at camera and everything else is stripped away, you've kind of got to be precise and you've got to use the time really well. And I think, you know, harnessing those skills and thinking, okay, what works best? And as Tim said, also the myth of attention spans being short, but but attention spans for boring stuff is not short. You know, we need the power of the Holy Spirit, but we do need to be interesting.
Yes.
Because if people are looking at content when they're not in the room, then they have the option to switch off, to fast forward at any moment. So we can't be sort of phased and paranoid. You think, I've got to be interesting, I've got to speak really fast, and there's got to be an explosion, you know, every 5 minutes just to keep everyone's attention. But we have got to at least think, you know, I want to really help people get to the end of this because it's good. So I do need to choose my words carefully and vary the pace, you know, and bring other things in and bring other people in and other voices in and make it so it flows and it's got a life to it and it's dynamic. In the end, we're not creating an entertainment program, but we are trying to get God's word across to people. So we need to be very creative in that process under God.
You're listening to a special edition of Unbelievable, asking, do we need to rethink worship in the age of COVID-19? This was an after-hours session recorded for Spring Harvest at Home just after Easter. Thanks to them for letting us re-air it here on Unbelievable. And we'll hear more of the questions that came in from the audience after a short break. Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. We often do Christian, non-Christian debates, and sometimes it's Christians getting together to discuss important issues as well. And that's what we're doing on today's show. I'm airing a special session from Spring Harvest at Home that I led just after Easter with a set of worship and church leaders asking, do we need to rethink worship in the age of COVID-19? Now, if you'd like to get your thoughts in on this, I would welcome your emails, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. What's been your experience? Perhaps it's very different to those of us here in the UK that are on this particular show today. Look forward to hearing your responses. You can, of course, get in touch on our social media too, @UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow the show on Facebook. I'm also over on Instagram and TikTok as Justin.Brierley. Later on in today's show, I'm chatting with an old university friend of mine as well, John Yates. He's got a new book out called Fractured, Why Our Societies Are Coming Apart and How We Can Put Them Back Together Again. And it's a really good book, actually. It's actually been endorsed by the Archbishop of Canterbury, no less. So that's a good person to have on the jacket of your book, isn't it? So you'll be hearing from John soon. Still to come this evening on the profile from 8 p.m, Richard Stearns, the president of World Vision from 98 to 2018, is going to be talking to Sam Hales about his life and ministry and his new book, Lead Like It Matters to God. That's on the profile tonight, also on the Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. And next week on this show, episode 4 of The Big Conversation, this season's Big Conversation. It's a big topic too. The fine-tuning of the universe for life is what we'll be debating. Was the cosmos made for us? Australian astrophysicist Luke Barnes will be joining me. He's become something of a world authority on making the case for fine-tuning. He's opposite Sabina Hossenfelder, a well-known physicist in Frankfurt, who says fine-tuning simply isn't a scientific question for her, and certainly doesn't point to God. So you'll find out more about that same time next week when we release the video and the podcast and, of course, are on air doing The Big Conversation, episode 4. That's all next week. And before we rejoin the conversation from Spring Harvest, just a quick shout out to Kedron Penny, who got in touch to say, I'm a 14-year-old Christian listener from the United States and recently discovered the podcast. The topics are thought-provoking and encouraging and have challenged me to dive headfirst into the hard questions about Christianity, only to be struck with awe about how great our God really is. I find myself listening, and occasionally a non-believer asks a question that I try to answer from 5,000 miles away and sometimes years in the future. Thank you for being a neutral moderator who asks honest questions. This show has been so encouraging to me and has strengthened my walk with Christ. Thank you. 5 stars. Kedron, so good to hear that a 14-year-old is listening to the show and getting so much out of it. So thank you for getting in touch. Look forward to hearing more of your thoughts on the show in the future. For now, let's get back into the final part of today's discussion. We've been asking, do we need to rethink worship in the age of COVID-19?
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
There's this great question which maybe you could all put something into, maybe we'll start with you, Luce. But it's very well put. It says, was COVID, or is COVID, more like an exile or an exodus which will lead us to somewhere new. So is it Just like, I sorry, it's that kind of, is it kind of being taken away from Jerusalem and the city we love and the temple, put into this strange land, the exile, or is it an exodus? Is it God leading us through difficult times, but to something, to the promised land? I don't know. But I just like the way it's put.
Yeah, it's a clever question, and there's a bit of, I think the answer is that it's a bit of everything. I mean, we're reminded of the psalm, aren't we, that the exiles sang, how can I sing the Lord's song in a strange land? And I think that's actually what we're asking tonight, is how can't I sing the Lord's song, because I'm not allowed to sing in this strange land that we're living in. But what we see in both of those great stories of Scripture, the exile and the Exodus, is that, you know, God had it all in hand. God's hand was at work. Why do we ever doubt? And yet the people of God are so good at forgetting, aren't we? We're so good at not remembering the faithfulness of God. It's just a theme that runs constantly throughout Scripture. And perhaps that's what I keep telling myself at the moment. You know, I'm a great planner. I want to know what's going to happen. I want to have it all lined up. And we can't at the moment. And so here we are just having to say, we trust in the faithfulness of God, who's going to go before us and show us the way. And he might just show us the way for the next couple of weeks. That's the land we're living in at the moment. And you know what? That's okay.
Great. Moira, exile or exodus?
I'm going to follow your wife and say it's a bit of everything. It's a bit of everything. But, you know, it's taken us, at least from the part of the church that I see, because, of course, we all see different parts of it. The parts of the church that I see, it's taken us into a bit of an exile where we've been stripped of a lot. But also it's taken us to a new place. Now, the question is, how much trust would we have in God on that journey? The technology is great. We must have it. But do I jump onto Clubhouse because there is Clubhouse? I mean, I know your Clubhouse has got like, is it 250,000 people now?
I'm not on Clubhouse, but I'm on TikTok. That's the one
TikTok,
I jumped on.
That's the one. Now, 250,000 people on TikTok. I'm looking at Justin Briley. Should I just jump? Our church must be on TikTok because Justin Briley is on TikTok. You know.
Can I just say, the only reason I'm on TikTok is because I have a 16-year-old son who has way more followers than me on TikTok. So it's all down to him. And I would never be on TikTok were it not for...
This is Justin's disclaimer here because he's not actually down with the kids at all.
But that's it. It's the young people leading the way and I'm just sort of being shepherded now.
We're gonna go on your TikTok and watch you with that board. What's that?
Which one?
That skateboard. Is it a skateboard or?
Oh, you're talking about one of my little demonstrations with.
And did you have your chest out?
No, I don't remember getting my chest out.
How are you watching?
You must be watching someone else's.
That's another Justin you're following. A female.
No, but
I haven't seen that one.
So I think sometimes in church we have a nervousness where we there's a new channel, we must be on it, and we see this at Premier a lot. So do we need to be on this? And I think there's something of trusting God and hearing His voice for the next step as we exile, as we do this this exodus to a place of promise. We're somewhat in exile, you know, somewhat it's an exodus, but through it all, I think the key thing for us as individuals, as church, is to hear God's voice, you know, what does he want for us? Because I can tell you now, Twitter is about to launch Spaces, which is a big thing. I mean, they're throwing a lot of money into it. And it's going to be another platform for you to have discussions. And when it becomes popular, it's, okay, our church needs to be in Spaces. But actually, do we need to be in Spaces? We just need to focus on who is... And here's a big thing with marketing and PR, which the two reverends have said. It's a question of who is our audience? mm-hmm. and where's their attention mm-hmm. at? You know, and we have to keep that in mind with the God sense behind us as we go through this Exodus movement of your people. Yes.
I'll get quick thoughts as well from Tim and Graham. Maybe start with Graham first. Exile or Exodus? This whole COVID period.
I guess exile, but probably neither. In the sense, it's more like just a period, a season of suffering and separation, and one that you know, whether you could say it's sent by God to purge the church or whatever, God will use it for good purposes. And you know, the discussions like we're having now are us saying, what is God teaching me through this? So I think it's definitely a season where we should be saying, what am I learning? What am I learning in a bad way that I've been trusting in that I need to let go of? What am I learning in a good way that I can start to use better for God's glory? So I think it's a learning time. It's a season of learning, and I hope we can learn under God.
Yeah. Tim, final thoughts from you?
Yeah, I see elements of both. Just to keep it interesting, I'm going to say Exodus. And I think God is leading his church into new territories, new opportunities. I think this is a real season of purging, of repentance and consecration. And I think one of the things that God is doing is he is, and this is if the church responds well and rightly. I fear that at times we've become too reliant on a Sunday gathering. Our churches have been so much energy in making this amazing hour and a half, the music, the talk, and all of that stuff's really, really important. But we have to be prepared that all of that stuff could go. And what are you left with? Yeah. How is the church able to be loving our neighbours, serving our communities? How are we discipling people? So if you can't gather, you can still experience and grow in what it is to be a worshipper, to develop muscles around prayer and study of scripture. And I think if people can take more and more responsibility for their life before God, their worship, then that is going to be very, 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 very exciting. I end with this quote. Former Archbishop of Canterbury, William Temple, once said, this world can be, this is during the Second World War, a radio broadcast. He said, this world can be saved from political chaos and collapse by one thing, and that is the worship of Jesus. And I don't think he was talking about singing a song. He was talking about a people, a church, so on fire for Jesus Christ, so surrendered to his wills and his ways, that actually they lived a life that completely transformed people around them. So that's the vision that I'm living for. And I pray and believe that's something of what God is doing.
Well, God bless you all. Thank you so much for being part of tonight's discussion. Thank you for watching from home. If you want to find out more about my guests, can I just quickly give you where to go? Moira is at moira.co.uk. Lucy, you can find out about the church there at wokingurc.org.uk. gasstreet.church for Tim, and affinity.org.uk for more about the network that Graham leads. And if you want more from Unbelievable, the show that I host on a weekly basis, just look us up on podcast, YouTube. And if you want more conversations, actually, we're doing a whole day, actually, looking at how we share the gospel in a post-COVID age on Saturday, the 15th of May, with people like N.T. Wright, Tom Holland, Claire Williams, and many others joining us for that. And it's all going to be live streamed, so unbelievable.live. But for now, thank you very much for all the questions, for a fantastic evening, and thanks very much to all my guests. And we hope you enjoy the rest of Spring Harvest at home.
Well, thanks again to Spring Harvest for allowing us to re-air that after-hours discussion that took place at this year's Spring Harvest at Home. The good news is Spring Harvest do plan to be back in person next year, though I'm sure there will be also be an online element to it, as I'm sure there will be for many conferences going forward. So look out for that on their website. I think in June the booking opens. That's springharvest.org. Thanks to all those who've been in touch about recent shows. It's always good to see your feedback coming in, but we're going to hold it over till next week, because right now I'd love to introduce you to a friend of mine. Well, joining me now on the show is John Yates. He's the author of Fractured: Why Our Societies Are Coming Apart and How We Put Them Together Again. John, welcome along to the program. And just for the sake of the audience, we do know each other. We have some history. University was where we met.
That's right.
Do you remember those days doing drama out on the streets? Is it a very vague, fuzzy memory for you?
I remember it very well. I mean, one of the things that I wrestle with in the book is the importance of intense experience to bring us together. And I remember a very early morning start. I don't know how early, but in my memory, it's sort of 4 a.m. It was probably something like 8, having to get up in the cold to do outdoor drama about faith, which is definitely an intense experience that I remember.
You're probably remembering like doing it on May Day,
Radcliffe Camera. That's exactly what I remember.
In Oxford, and basically all these hungover revelers from May Day balls kind of basically wandering through in their, you know, formal wear. And us doing these kind of evangelistic dramas on the side of the square.
I like to think that they were celebrating the drama. That was really the pinnacle. They'd stayed up all night just to get a good spot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. Well, those were the days, I tell you, some 20 plus years ago.
It's all been downhill since that.
When we were students and we were, doing that kind of thing. I mean, and that is a clue to the fact that you are a Christian, and we met sort of through sort of Christian circles at Oxford. But tell us about, you know, catch me up on what you've been doing in the 20 years since, John. What's been the sort of stuff you've been involved in, and how did it all lead to this book?
Yeah, so I have a career that makes absolutely no sense at all, Justin. My parents had an absolutely clear plan for my life up to about the age of 20, and then they basically ran out of ideas. And and so it's been put down to me, which has been incredibly sort of all over the place. So I came to London with the plan of being a stand-up comedian. Clearly our drama hadn't sort of beaten it all out of me.
Some stand-up comedy at university as well.
That's right.
I'm sure I came to one of those shows.
Well, I was shockingly consistently mediocre, which is the worst, because you're not good enough to really love it, but you're not bad enough to have brilliant stories when you talk about how you failed at it. And so I ended up as a community worker in Newham in the East End of London, one of the first parts of the UK to be majority ethnic minority. And then I accidentally clicked on the wrong thing on a website and applied to work as a management consultant. I genuinely clicked on the wrong thing. And I only went to the interview because they were going to pay for my travel. And I had no money and I fancied a day out. That was honestly the logic. And for those who don't know management consultants, you know, I'd encourage you to think of a friend who gives you advice that you didn't necessarily ask for and imagine that they charged you for it. But I love that job. I then ended up in international development. I was keen to try and make some sort of a difference, and found myself in Kenya, in Nairobi. And I was there when there were serious race riots due to an election that went very badly wrong. In some ways, it went brilliantly, because the downside of an election is only one person wins. Well, in this one, two people won, which was obviously the cause of the huge dispute. And then I came back to the UK and wanted to try and do something positive here. And I'd become obsessed by networks and connections. And I'd seen Nairobi and Kenya actually pull itself apart due to a lack of mixing and connection between groups of people and what tribes can do to a society. And I was worried that the same thing was happening in the West. And so I came back to start trying to do something about it.
I mean, in some ways, that is what the book is about, the modern Western forms of tribalism that now exist. Where does this all come from? Why do we all live now in these silos where we basically only see and hear people who look and sound and think like us? Can you describe what those are and why they've come about?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting curiosity that we seem to have been surprised by the fact we were divided. It seems to have sort of crept up on us. Like many of us have woken up after elections and gone, how has that happened? I don't know anyone who voted that way. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know anyone who voted the other way. And we seem to have been sort of caught unawares by our divisions. And yet when we looked at our friendships, when we look at the sort of small number of people that maybe in the UK at the moment, you're only allowed six people in your house. If you look at those people, they are often quite similar to us. Mm-hmm. You know, that we tend to spend time with people of the same education level. So half of half of people in the US and the UK who have degrees only have friends with degrees. We tend to spend time with people of the same age as us. There's a fascinating, sort of terrifying statistic about the United States, for example, where only one in 20 senior citizens spend time talking to anyone under the age of 40 who they're not related to each month. Like, it's just incredibly rare for those contacts to happen. We're strikingly divided by ethnicity and by race. Again, half of us tend to have no friends who are of a different ethnic group. And yet our greatest division is probably by wealth. In the UK at the moment, I'm allowed 30 people in my garden. As a professional person, you know, someone earning a reasonable amount of money for my job, I would actually have to invite 100 people before I would be likely to invite someone who is unemployed. You know, our networks just are really segregated by choice to a large degree. So the question is, why is it like this? And there's a sort of a desire, I think, to blame society. You know, it's caused by something out there that's pulling us apart.
I'm a completely diverse, lovely person. It's just all those social forces I have no control over. That's
right. It's everyone else. And what the science actually shows us is that we have this tendency, this bias that just pulls us towards people who are a bit like us. I call it in the book, people like me syndrome.
PLM syndrome.
We just have this slight bias. And it's not some awful, terrible thing. It can mean that, you know, gingerhead people like me normally wearing glasses, who like talking about geeky political theory books, might stumble across another gingerhead person with glasses who likes political theory books. That's not going to shake Western civilization. It's not totally the end of the world.
Sure.
The problem is when it gets to extremes, when I only know people who are all Christians, when I only know people who all vote a certain way, when I only know people from a certain ethnic background, it's really hard for me to empathize and understand with the rest of the country.
But are there some factors that are, if you like, contributing to and accelerating that? I mean, we've heard a lot about the way social media, far from getting everyone into this lovely, diverse cultural mix, has actually continued that segregation process by saying, well, if you like this, we'll just deliver you people and thoughts and articles that you like. And so has that natural inclination that somehow exists in us been, if you like, exaggerated by technology?
It has. And social media is a huge accelerator for people like me syndrome, because we have. Why do I say that? Because if I want to change who my neighbour is, I have to move house. Like, that's quite a big move. If I want to change who I'm friends with at school, I've got to move friendship group. It's not as big as moving house, but it's still a move. If I want to change who I follow on Twitter, I just click a button. And so people like me syndrome, that ability to choose who I follow is so easy that we do end up. But one of the things I do want to challenge is that social media is a big part of the story. Mm-hmm. It's part of the story. But I think it misses something. And actually, I think it's a totally different technology that's played a much bigger part, which is television. Mm-hmm. So I love the television. I love West Wing. I love W1A here in the UK. There's a load of shows. I'm a huge fan of TV. But what we've seen over the last 50 years is a huge decline in the physical spaces, in real life spaces, where we used to interact with people we didn't choose to meet. Mm-hmm. One of those spaces is clubs. Our grandparents, people just 40 years older than us, were twice as likely to join a club or a society. What's the biggest thing that's made a difference to joining clubs and societies? It's the expansion of the television. Mm-hmm. Now, I think you can sort of approach that and go, what John Yates is arguing for is we turn back the clock. We go back to the 1950s, we ban TV, we all operate in the way we used to back then. I don't want to argue that. I think there's a lot of things that are very problematic about the 1950s. But I do want to say that we have lost something. We've lost some of these spaces. Another one is schools. Mm. Schools were huge places where people would just go to the local school. And actually, one of the things that's changed in the last 50 or 60 years is we now have so much more choice, many of us, about where we send our children to school. And the result is we tend to bias towards schools that have children that look a bit like our children. Now, what I want to push is say, we're going to have to create again new spaces. It won't be the same as the old, but we need to find new spaces that bring people together. But churches can be a big part.
Well, I was going to say, does this apply to churches? I mean, in theory, the church is a place where people across socioeconomic, racial and other lines would meet together. You know, that at the heart of it is this idea that there is neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, slave nor free, all are one in Christ. There is this vision, at least at the heart of Christianity, of a truly multicultural, multigenerational community. Is that what we see in practice? arguably, churches are just as split down racial lines, you know, especially in places like the States, as any other part of society. So what's your analysis of that?
Yeah, so Martin Luther King famously said that 11 a.m. on the Sunday was the most segregated hour in America. We shouldn't, as Christians, the truth is our friend. The truth will set us free. So let's tell the truth. Our churches have a history in the UK, in the US, around the world, of having a problem with mixing people and welcoming people of different ethnic backgrounds. We have a problem with it, and we need to be much more on the front foot about addressing it. The truth also is that the church is a really good place historically for people of different income brackets and different ages to come together. Not perfect, mm-hmm. but actually much better than the rest of society. And so there is work that we have to do, particularly around race in our churches. Who are the people that we're seeing up front mm-hmm. when you go into a church? Do you see people from different ethnic backgrounds? You know, if your church is predominantly white, is there someone in the congregation who's not white, who's at the front? It's so important to make people feel welcome. Do we think about the way that we talk and the language that we use? I don't want to police language. I don't think that helps us. But do we make sure our language is welcoming, that we recognize people, the names that we use in stories? Do we just send little signals that everyone's welcome? Do we have people in our churches who go out their way to welcome new people? So things we have to do, but there's also stuff to celebrate. And I think at the heart of that is that church has always churches Christianity is based on an example in Jesus of someone who went to talk to the woman at the well, who went to a male Jew sitting and talking and listening with a woman Samaritan. And we have to, you know, some things we can do are quite small, Justin. What are we doing to actually just say hello to people in the street? Mm-hmm. What are we doing to welcome our neighbours, to practice hospitality? What are we doing in our churches to make sure that we put on events and activities that get people mixing and meeting? But finally, what are we doing as a group of Christians who believe in the woman at the well to actually say to our governments, actually, I think more needs to be done to reunite our countries, and more spaces need to be created to bring people together.
I mean, the assumption throughout everything you've been saying, and it's a shared kind of assumption by me, is that it's good to create spaces where people who are different meet each other. And the fact that we've become polarized and insulated from each other into these different groups is a bad thing. But just expand on that. Why is it a bad thing? Arguably, birds of a feather flock together. There is a sort of natural inclination bias for people of similar shared background and interests to get on, you know, and it's likely like you can force, you know, some sort of integration where, you know, inevitably people with the same interests and so on will naturally talk to each other. So what's bad? What where's that tipping point, if you like, where actually you then start to feel kind of the really negative effects of when that goes to a certain level, I suppose?
Yeah, it's such an important question. I think there's a danger that we sort of just think getting people to mix is good, full stop, because it's obviously good. And it's sort of, it's aesthetically pleasing. We like the idea of people mixing up, and isn't it lovely? And isn't that great? I think that's a terribly unhelpful way actually to think about it, because, you know, we need to be much more, what's the evidence? What's the proof? And so let's pick some things that we really care about. Let's just pick two. So first one would be social mobility. So technical way of just saying children, no matter who you're born to, having opportunities to get on in life. Like, most of us want to live in a society where who you're born to and where you live, you've still got a good chance. Talent is evenly spread, but opportunities are not. How do we make it fairer? The truth is, and we know this to be true, we even have a saying that says it's not just what you know, it's who you know. you know, opportunities don't just fall out of the tree. They come from the networks and the connections that we have. You know, why did I have to accidentally apply for that job in management consulting? I was really good at that job, but I assumed I would never be interviewed or offered that job. Why? Because nobody I knew worked in business. Everyone I knew was either a vicar, a teacher, a doctor, or something else. It just wasn't imagined to me. And that's someone who's got quite an advantaged background. So many of the children that I work with today, they don't have the networks, they don't have the connections, they don't imagine that they can do certain things. Mm-hmm. So the first thing, if we want to live in a fairer society, these networks and spreading them is just unavoidably needed. The second is democracy. You know, most of us are really proud of our democracies. You know, are they perfect? No, they're not. But we are proud of the fact that actually we get to vote out people and we get to vote people in. But if we don't know half of our country, if we don't understand the problems that they have, it's really hard for us to vote in an informed way. Somebody say here in the UK, the problem with the Prime Minister is he doesn't know the price of a pint of milk. Well, every 4 years I get to vote on who the Prime Minister is. I think I do know the price of the pint of milk, but do I know anyone who obsessively needs to know the price of a pint of milk? Do I understand the lives of the desperately poor? Do I understand the lives of a small business person? If I don't understand these issues, how can I vote well? How can our democracy function well? In fact, all the danger is we become, back to Kenya and my experience of short time there, we become like two or three tribal groups, and the people that will take advantage of that, and they'll tell us half-truths and lies to take a particular group with them. And we'll feel like our choices suddenly become very poor when it comes to voting. And I think we see on all sides, we see elements of this at the moment on both sides of the Atlantic.
I think that's really, really helpful. To what degree then do you think the solution is in sort of, as it were, consciously creating opportunities for people? Give you an example. You and I both went to Oxford University, and it's, I'm sure like me, you're aware of just the privilege in a sense that gives a person, you know, the sort of leg up in life that does, but also the fact that by and large that opportunity is more open to people like you and me from a certain racial, social background than others. I have a friend, Claire Williams, who was just at our conference recently, and she also went to Oxford. She's from a Black British background, and she has recently started a campaign with Jesus College, I think, where she went, to help to increase the intake of young people from less sort of well-to-do backgrounds, young Black men and women who want to, you know, they would like to give more opportunity and see that sort of. And I think that's amazing and brilliant that there's a conscious decision to try and see those opportunities opened up. But of course, you will get people on the other side who say, but you know, this is like kind of like a forcing some kind of supposed equity, some sort of people on the conservative end of the spectrum who will say you're kind of trying to create some sort of situation which isn't sort of where things naturally pan out, and it's going to lead to people who would have been, you know, more qualified, let's say, to be going to Oxford, their place of being given to people who are less qualified. And it's how do you work out that sort of dynamic, you know, because there are obviously arguments on both sides when it comes to those sorts of.
Yeah. So I think two things strike me. One is that the tendency to see the system as natural, I think, is highly aligned as to whether the system advantages you or not. So if when we look at, say, the people going to Oxford, and we find ourselves thinking, oh yeah, well, I would like it to be fair, but I don't think you should interfere with the natural system. The best people should be allowed to go there. That feels quite credible if you happen to be part of the people who naturally tend to go there. If you're if my life had been a bit different, and I'd had the same sort of DNA, the same basic makeup, hopefully the same sort of capability. But I've been born to someone in a very poor part of town. I think I might look at it a bit differently and say the natural state doesn't seem very fair to me, and it doesn't seem to represent the best people getting the opportunity. So I think the first thing is if we're coming, especially as Christians, I think our judgment of what is fair, and assuming that's the same as what we happen to judge as natural in a world that is fallen, I think we've got to be pretty careful with that judgment. I think the second thing I'd say is, what is it we ultimately value if we're coming from a more conservative perspective? Most of those of us who would count ourselves as conservatives, I think, value freedom deeply. And we value the freedom to freedom from being interfered with, and the freedom to live a good and honest life. Well, at the core of that, we need a government that is just and is not going to be captured by authoritarians who are going to force us to do X, Y, and Z. Well, the truth is, where do authoritarians have the best chance of taking over our governments? It's in a divided society. And so Nazi Germany was not some utopian altogether, group of people. You know, our societies where a leader comes and can say, I am here for the real people. I am here for you, not them. I'm here for you. That's where our freedoms get most trampled on. And the difficult truth is, if we don't mix, that's a bigger risk. And I think we've got to be grown up about it and say, look, if we want the conditions that protect us from authoritarianism, that create the opportunity to have an equal chance, that actually also create a society where people are less anxious. You know, mixing is so important because it realizes we don't have to be afraid of everybody.
It's how do you kind of enable, though, that to happen in a sort of hopefully organic, genuine way, rather than what can sometimes unfortunately be the case, which is a more tokenistic box-ticking way of, oh, we need to have X number of women and people of color on such and such a board because there's some sort of new cultural expectation. Now, that may be coming from the right place, but often it can feel false or a sort of tokenistic and not genuinely about, what you're talking about.
Let me be a bit more radical. So we're talking a bit about how do people get access to jobs and how do people get on boards, which is exactly where you go, I think, historically, because we're thinking about fairness and we're thinking about power. I'm not so interested in that. It's important, but I think it's a side element of the story. I'm interested in how does every single person have a wider network of connections. Let's look at a different country. Let's look at Singapore. So Singapore became a country by accident. It was thrown out of the Malay Federation. It didn't want to leave. It was chucked out. Incredibly small country, incredibly vulnerable, doesn't have enough land to feed its people, doesn't have enough people to defend itself. It's in a terrible, parlous state. The leader of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, goes on national television and weeps. He is so concerned for the future of his country. What's his number one concern? It's not defense. It's not feeding the country. It's the danger of racial division. That's his number one concern. Singapore is made up of a mixture of Chinese, Indians and Malays. And he's terrified the country's going to split and divide and become taken over by authoritarians and become a horrible place. So his number one priority is to avoid that. What does he do? He doesn't come up with tick box exercises. He doesn't say who's going to be on the board. He says, I am going to create institutions that knit people together. And he focuses on three areas: schools. How do we make sure schools bring together children who are from Malay, Indian and Chinese background? He focuses on national service. Now, national service, he needs it for defence as well. But he creates an institution, a rite of passage for all young Singaporeans to go through where they will mix with people from different backgrounds. And he controversially focused on housing. In Singapore, they actually allocate housing on the basis of your ethnic background to get a mix. Now, I'm not suggesting we do the third one here in the West, but his approach he's not interested in fairness. He's not interested in box ticking. He's saying, if this country is going to be a good place to live, we have to get people to mix. And no one from a conservative viewpoint could look at Singapore and say it's some sort of socialist, attempt to. I mean, this is a free market, pro-business, extraordinary sort of right wing sort of place from that point of view. But he was saying, no, we need society to mix. And I think what we've gained in the West is we've had an accidental, wonderful heritage, not perfectly, and on race in particular, we've been very problematic, but in many ways, from an income point of view, from people coming from different villages and countries into cities, we've benefited from clubs and societies, places of worship, from mandatory schooling, and from people generally working in single workplaces that were local to them. And that is all falling away. And we are riding on the benefit of it. And I think it's naive for us to think that we can just let it go and have no cost.
Yeah. So without turning the clock back to the 1950s, as you say, what any practical suggestions, you know, the kind of thing that someone listening to this right now could go out and do if they recognize, actually, yeah, when I look around, I realize I really don't know people who are much different to me. What can we do, John?
Yeah, so look, let me approach it like this. I think this problem is a little bit, at least in this way, a little bit like if you care about the climate. You don't have to believe in the climate to believe in this issue, but if you believe in the climate, this is a helpful way to think about it. I think most people say there are things individuals can do to help with climate change. There are things individuals can do to help with this. So, for example, join a club, get involved. Find a sport that you want to learn. Join something where you don't choose the people who are there. That gets around people like me syndrome. Join something. Second thing you can do have a look. If you are a manager, just think about how you recruit. Where do you advertise? You know, that's not about box ticking. Just where do you advertise? Is it actually reaching a different group of people? Are you asking for a degree when you don't need a degree? So there are things you do as a manager. Mm-hmm. There's things you can do as a neighbour. Do you invite people around to your house? Do you invite your neighbours around? Do you have one day a year?
Well, yeah. Not the last year.
When it's legally allowed.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
So there are things, and the book includes at the end 32 things an individual can do right now. So there are things we can do.
Yeah.
Just like climate change, we're naive, I think, if we think it's all down to just individuals and that will solve the problem. The challenge of the book is to say we've either got to accept that we're going to be divided for quite a long period of time because we've lost these common life experiences that knit us together, or we've got to accept the idea that it might be right for the government to find ways, as they did in Singapore, to knit not just a few people, not just people into positions of power, but all of us a bit more together. And I think there are ways to do that in a Western society that won't rob us of liberty, that are about actually community service as part of the national curriculum for children, about free parenting classes where you meet other parents locally when you have a child, about a national retirement service so that when you retire you don't lose connection, you meet new people. I think things like that would be massively popular actually, and could really fit with Western society, but we haven't really even discussed these ideas for decades.
Yeah, wow. Lots of interest and challenge and practical suggestions there. Really helpful. I hope that in some small way, you know, what I've been trying to do with Unbelievable for the last 10 to 15 years, I have seen the benefit of reaching across those lines and having honest, open conversations. Because, you know, in my particular niche, Christian apologetics, the Christian sort of world, theology and so on, it is very easy to just basically talk to people who think and act the same way as you and assume, therefore, my way of thinking must be the only way that makes sense. And you quickly realize once you actually begin to have the conversations, you stop seeing people as just an idea to be debated, but a person to actually be engaged. And there's something about that I've experienced that helps you to see things far more holistically. And in the long run is much more beneficial than just kind of debating abstract people, and that's, I guess, has always been the danger, you know, that we tend to see people in those terms. But
and there's something, isn't there, about seeing that just respecting a person for being a person, for being a child of God first and foremost. You know, back to Jesus and the woman at the well, he doesn't turn up with a tract and say, look, he doesn't say to his disciples, right, this is one we're going to get. I've got a plan to get this person onto our side. He goes there with a compassion and an interest in her as a person and who she is. And from that he shares. And I think sometimes as Christians, we can, if we believe in evangelism, we can see people as tools to be persuaded or tricked or convinced or revealed to. And I don't think that's how Jesus saw the woman at the well. I think he saw her as a human being, just like he was. as a first step. I think that's incredibly important. We come back to that.
It's a great book, Fractured, Why Our Societies Are Coming Apart and How We Put Them Together Again. It's by John Yates. And I'll make sure there's a link from today's show where you can find out more about it. It's due to be released very soon in the UK, in September in the US, but it's all available for pre-order now. John, thank you so much for writing the book and talking to me about it today.
An absolute pleasure, Justin. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being with us on the show today. Don't forget, you can find out more about Unbelievable at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for the show page. You can get the podcast there. You can also subscribe to the newsletter. You can support the show as well. And of course, you can find links to unbelievable.live where you can get all of the sessions from this year's Unbelievable Conference as a digital download. For now, thanks very much for being with us on the show today. Episode 4 of the current season of The Big Conversation is coming your way next week, and it's a biggie. The fine-tuning of the universe for life. Was the cosmos made for us, we'll be asking, with Australian astrophysicist Luke Barnes arguing for the fine-tuning of the universe and that it points to a creator. He's opposite Sabina Hossenfelder, well-known physicist in Frankfurt, who says fine-tuning isn't a scientific question and doesn't point to God. You be the judge, though, of who makes the case next week. Look forward to hearing your responses. That's The Big Conversation next time on Unbelievable. Until then, have a good week.